Session number 9314.
Major Hill, Reel 2. Would you like to make some more comments about patrolling?
Yes, as I've said, there's something they don't seem to have grasped. Their idea of patrolling, I saw one or two of the local army patrols. They, of course, had a substantial number of Vietnamese units fighting alongside them. And I was much amazed one evening when the colonel said, come and look at one of our patrols which is going out. And there was a rabble of about 50 or 60 people. And literally, when I say a rabble, I mean one, and no sort of order or anything, just wandering off into the dark. And I said to the colonel, they're not very likely to catch anybody. He said, catch anybody? No, the object is to keep the other side away and so you don't see them. And they simply hadn't grasped it at all. And that's why, as I keep repeating, they lost control of the countryside by night, including the main roads. And every morning they had to start off by clearing the roads. And it just didn't mean anything to talk to them, you know, it didn't mean anything to them. And say, why don't you get some good chaps and send them out and to sit on the road and knock these chaps off as they come in to place the lines and so on. But it's just was alien to their way of thinking.
Had you observed a similar temperament amongst the French troops in Korea?
I never saw them. But I tell you, when we did the Korean tapes about the Americans and how when we took over a position which we'd been in, when we went out of the line and then came back and took over the same position, what a terrible state it was in. All the wire had been cut to the Chinese. The place was in a real hopeless mess. And despite them, you know, the theoretically the most perfect patrolling system, the thing is they hadn't actually gone out and done it, and that's what you've got to do. And it took us, as I said then, several days to get the Chinese to realize that it wasn't safe to come poking around the wire at night, and get the wire right and all that sort of thing. And it was certainly much worse in Indochina. The patrolling was non-existent, except, I believe, in the Australian and New Zealand areas when they were up there. I went to spend Christmas, again, this was fixed the time, with the headquarters at Hanoi. And this is, I think, part of the thing which gave me not a very good impression of them. It struck me that the staff were far too keen on leading La Dolce Vita and not looking after the troops and so on. Well, you know, at Christmas, naturally, everybody's going to have a bit of a party. But there are limits to what one should do, and there's the atmosphere in which one does it. And I think this is the fault of, if I may put it, French and Italian staffs. Generally, I think that it's an opportunity to have an easy time, and it doesn't weigh very heavily on them that somebody else has actually got to do the fighting. And I think that was really part of the trouble.
Did you get the impression that the headquarters in Hanoi were out of touch with what was going on in the field?
Yes, I did get the impression that they were a bit out there. And what was worse, they weren't frightfully interested. Now, this may have been, of course, because they knew that they were shortly going to pull out. And we had a British consul up in Hanoi, whose main object was collecting intelligence. And he asked me if I'd seen or heard anything about pulling out. And I said, no, I hadn't. And he said, well, I think they're going to do it all right. And he was perfectly right. And so I suppose that the French staff up there had really lost interest. The main idea was to keep one's skin intact until they pulled out, which they did.
Did the officers in the Legion express any opinion of the staff or of their direction from Hanoi?
No, they didn't. They were very correct about that. They no criticism at all. Or of the people down in Saigon. I think they, if I remember rightly, I think they put in a good word for their Legion chaps down in Saigon, who were, as I've said, very competent.
Now, you say you went on several other attacks with them. Did they go off in the same sort of fashion?
Yes, they weren't as big as that one. I did one or two company and two company operations, but they were all very much the same pattern. That is, they formed up, attacked the village, and then loosed the Vietnamese people in the village to see if they could pick anybody up there. They had very little success, as far as I could see. The Viet Cong, I got news in advance, or disappeared, because there was never really a pitched battle.
Never any real opposition, then?
Never any real opposition, that's it.
Did they ever put out stops beyond the village, opposite the front of attack, when they went in?
My impression is that in the battalion attack I was talking about, they did have people out, but I don't think they did in any of the smaller attacks. They and they was very nervous, I think, putting out small detachments. They'd had one or two unfortunate experiences when they'd run into big bodies and, you know, have their chaps hacked to pieces. Because there was no mercy shown to prisoners on either side. The Viet Cong got hold of you, they hack you in pieces as soon as look at you. But it's easy, of course, to sit here and criticize, but I could never really make out why they didn't show a more active front in all these villages, going, you know, and make sure that the Viet Cong didn't get a base there at all and try and root them out. It seemed to be these endless attacks, which afterwards you ended up no better off than you were before. I remember they knocked off four or five Viet Cong. There seemed to be no effort to gain control of the country and perhaps bring people back and what's called, I think, villagization now. But of course the north was a difficult area where the Viet Cong were very strong and they could always get reinforcements and so on.
Now, I think you said that you went on some attacks with the ordinary French troops rather than the Legion. Was there any noticeable difference in technique in the way in which they operated?
Yes, I thought the French troops were very much less efficient than the Legion. I remember in the report, which is I wrote for the War Office, which is lost, they were much impressed by an account I gave of the brigade commander whom padded around in bedroom slippers, which struck me as very unfavourably. But they were very sloppy up there, there's no doubt about it. What I never saw out there, for some reason, was French colonial infantry, who were supposed to be much better than the others. But I didn't think much of them.
Did you ever see any helicopters or other air support?
No. I've got an idea, you know, that a helicopter was a considerable rarity at this time. I don't think they'd come in the big way then. They're in now. And, there was air support, I believe, but I certainly never saw anything of it. But probably I wasn't engaged in the sort of operation which would justify it. But of course, That's one of the main bones of contention at Yen Bien Phu, wasn't it? We warned them, and everybody warned them, that they were going outside their air cover, which indeed they were. And that's why the Viet Cong won Dien Bien Phu by using artillery, and there's nobody to knock it up. That was the thing. And after my time up in the north, when I came down, I then was more or less given a bit of a holiday, which the French are very good at, and I went down to a beautiful place, Da Nang or somewhere, about halfway down the coast between Hanoi and Saigon, and somewhere near, I never got there, I wish I had, place where Ngoc Man is made. I don't know if you know what Ngoc Man is. It's fish juice. I've got some next door in the kitchen, actually. I'll give you a little before you go. And it's the vitamin content of the Vietnamese diet. And it's made out of dried fish on one particular island. And apparently nobody who isn't sort of brought up to it can go there because the stink is so absolutely foul. The stuff itself doesn't smell bad and tastes very good. But the smell of the place is absolutely frightful. And when I'd done that, I then went back to Saigon, where, as I said earlier in the tapes, I went and inspected the Legion headquarters there, and which was very good, and then had another go around the French GHQ, and had a look at the town. There was a huge casino there, and that was quite interesting, because there'd been a number of unfortunate incidents there, and you had to be closely examined for weapons before they'd let you inside. By closely examining, they would had to turn your pockets out, and had Vietnamese soldiers feeling you all over to make sure you hadn't got a gun. It was really very thoroughly done. I was amused. I went down there in a taxi and paid the taxi driver, and then I saw him following me into the casino to put the money I'd given him on the tables. They're diabolical gamblers. And then when it was all over, I then of course went back to I was very sorry I couldn't get into Cambodia to those famous temples, what are they called?
Angkor Wat.
Angkor Wat, that's it, yes. But there were, for some reason, they wouldn't let me go there. I think there was some trouble they didn't want me to see, or they didn't want me to be caught there. There was a good deal all the time of worry, particularly on the British side, that somehow I'd get myself compromised. And there'd be a frightful howl that we were aiding the French in this colonial war. There was a great difference of opinion between ourselves and the Aussies and New Zealanders, who both sent contingents. But I think they must have had a socialist government at the time, because certainly they were very nervous that anything would happen. In fact, the French very kindly, I didn't do anything to deserve it, the French very kindly offered me quite a gare, but I wasn't allowed to accept it.
Now you mentioned the GHQ in Saigon, that they had plenty of secretaries. Were these local girls?
No.
They were French, were they?
Yes. They thoroughly got that into their heads, that if you want to have security, you can't have local people on them, staff.
And were these girls actually in the army?
Yes. Yes. They were sort of the equivalent of fannies, that sort of thing.
When you got back to Saigon, to the GHQ there, did you find that they had a good idea of what was going on up in the north and the operational areas.
It's difficult to say. They were very cagey, and I think this was probably because of the pullout, and they didn't want to say anything which would reveal what their future intentions were. Of course, there were a very large number of troops there, and GHQ wouldn't really take much interest in what a regiment was doing. But I also not yet. My impression is that they thought things weren't going at all well, that they'd got that into their heads. Well, they must have done, otherwise they wouldn't have pulled out of the place. And the military attaché, or our military attaché there, he was firmly convinced that, you know, things were going in a bad way up there and they were going to pull out. Because it's, they had a lot of troops up there. It was much bigger than anything we do. You know, if we have 20,000 troops in a place, it's the end of the world. They had, of course, far, far more than that. They didn't believe in having two men and a boy. They had a big commando training school up in the north, too. All that had to go, you see.
When you got back to Malaya, did you find that there was a close and intense interest in what you discovered? Were you debriefed very thoroughly?
No, I wrote a report and sent it up to GHQ, and that was it. I don't think they were frightfully interested. I think they thought they were much better, which indeed they were. But I'll tell you one little side story, it might be amusing. I don't know if it's true or not. It is said that when Gerald Templer arrived in Malaya, he would might start a bit earlier. Do you know the story about how he was sent there by Churchill? Well, I won't bother bore you with it again. But anyway, when he got there, he summoned together every officer of the rank of lieutenant colonel and above, and walked onto the stage in his usual immaculate dress. And he stood there for about 2 minutes, just looking at him. And then he said, "I've had a good look at you, and I hope you've had a good look at me, because I'm the boss." Now, I've heard that when General De Lattre went out to take control in Indochina, he called it to see Templer on the way, and had a talk with him, how he ran the place and so on. And I think Templer must have told him the story, because when he got to Indochina, he summoned all the senior officers there and said to them, "Moi, je suis le maréchal Lattre de Tassigny. Je prends le commandement." And then what he did, well, that was, I believe, Christmas when he arrived, he started immediately a big airborne operation, the main object of which was to make sure that the staff didn't booze it up over Christmas, because it was frightfully unpopular, of course, but he was a big chap, and he just pushed it through, and he said, "I want two airborne battalions moved from here to wherever it was," and so on and so forth. "Oh, it's Christmas, I said, "Damn it, get out." And I think that shook them up a good deal.
Did you meet him or any of the other senior French commanders on your
visit? The answer to that is no. I didn't stop curious that, actually. When I went to Madagascar, I met the commander-in-chief and the commanders of the three services. But when I went to Indochina, to the best of my knowledge and belief, I never met anybody Harlan, the sort of chief of the operations branch and the chief administration and so on. I suppose it was a much bigger show, and they thought, quite rightly, that it wasn't worth their while talking to a major. Thanks, it was a big show. They had, I forgot how many people they had there. My impression is something like 150,000 or something like that.
Perhaps it was a measure of their desire to maintain discretion.
Yes. Whereas, of course, the people in Madagascar have got nothing to be discreet about. There's nothing going on there, no operations. Well, that's about it for Indochina, I think.
Could you say something about the state of affairs in western Sumatra when you parachuted in 1945?
Yes. The situation there was that when VJ Day came, of course, the local commander was made to throw his hand in, but the British Army was not able to really to occupy the place because they were all prepared for something called Operation Zipper, which was an attack on the west coast of Malaya, I think. And so what they decided to do was to parachute in some SOE people who had been waiting in Ceylon to carry out operations in various places. I was supposed to go to Siam. And so we set off from Trincomalee, I think, and flew for a long way, 10 hours flight, I think, before parachuting down in Padang on the west coast of Sumatra. I think that's right. There's another place called Medang, which is on the opposite side, but I think it was Padang we went. Anyway, it was certainly on the west side. And we parachuted down onto the aerodrome, which caused me a good deal of alarm, because I was frightened we could have fallen on the concrete at one moment. However, we didn't, we were all right. And there was a Dutch SOE team in there, who were shortly afterwards withdrawn, except for their wireless set, which I took over. And then on our job, there was, as I said, there was myself, there was somebody in Medang, and there was someone down further south. My job was to get in touch with the Japanese army and make sure that they maintained law and order until the British army arrived, which it took them about 4 weeks to do, if I remember rightly, if not five. And the situation was really very awkward, because the Japanese were doing, their policy was to do everything they could to stir up the locals against the Dutch and the British and try and sort of save a bit from the war that way. And they succeeded very substantially, because the locals very nearly took over the town on one occasion, until I had to go and see the Japanese corps commander and tell him, on the instructions of GHQ in Singapore, it was by then, that unless he did something about it, he'd be treated as a war criminal and severely punished when the British troops did arrive. And I think he hauled in, he'd got to do something or he's going to be in serious trouble. So what he did, in fact, was get a regiment and deploy it in the town with machine guns on every corner, a little sort of section post there. And what they used to do was they used to fire at irregular intervals. so that the wretched locals never knew when it was safe to be on the streets or not. And that kept them all in their houses. And there was, you could have heard a pin drop after they'd been there for, 12 hours. And he told them, I'm going to take the soldiers away now. If there's the slightest bit of trouble, they'll come back and stay for twice as long. So after that, there was absolute peace and quiet. Well, they were frightened of the Japanese, you see. They, I think they thought the British would be a pretty easy pushover, but they were frightened of them. They knew that if they said something, they meant it. There was one frightful outrage. After we'd taken over, the brigade major of the brigade, which was based on Padang, took a local rat. She was a Red Cross girl, some idiot had sent in, down to swim on some beach a few miles out of the town. And the locals got hold of them and tortured them both to death. Well, luckily there weren't any press there, so the brigadier went down there with a company of Gurkhas, and he said, "Who done it?" All the villagers stood there showing dumb insolence. So he lined up all the men and got hold of a Gurkha sergeant major, and he went down the line bayoneting them until somebody's nerve cracked, and he told them who done it. And then he got hold of them, had their heads hacked off with kukris, burnt the village. And again, after that, you could have heard a pin drop. But it's, as my father's sergeant major used to say in Egypt in the First World War, there's only one way to treat these here bloody niggers, severity, always justice if possible. And that certainly calmed things down there.
So there were no further incidents after that?
There were no further incidents after that. And as I say, there was no further incidents after the Japanese general put the the troops into the town. I suppose there's a lesson there, but it's one which I don't think we'll ever learn.